Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, it's Angela, and we are really excited today to bring you a special podcast. I have with me two individuals from public knowledge. First, I would like to introduce Stacy Moss. She's the president and CEO of Public Knowledge. She has over 20 years in the field. She's been a lawyer, a law clinic director, and has also done a good deal of consulting. Welcome, Stacy.
Thank you, Angela. Nice to be with you again.
And we also have Will Hornsby. Will is a senior vice president of delivery with an MSW and over 28 years of experience in the field. He's worked at both the state and federal levels, and a big focus of his work has been on effectiveness of programs. Welcome, Will.
Thanks.
Glad you're here. The book that we're talking about today is called Families Belong Together, A Call to Replace the Child Welfare System. Stacy, I want to start with you. You have written a very powerful foreword to the book, and I think our listeners who are engaged in this policy work all know the discussion around abolishing the system and how that's really created a tension in the field of people not really understanding how that could happen when we're already not giving families the resources they need. And so I would love it if you could talk to our audience a little bit about the concept of replacement and some of the ideas you have there at Public Knowledge.
Yeah, thanks. I feel stuck a lot of times, right, in this conversation between how do we improve the system or abolish it, right, blow it all up. And I think the reality is neither of those are good enough for the kids and the families that we work with. So the language that we've been using and the work that we've been working on for the last 5 years is replacing. And a big part of replacing is completely reimagining the system, right? Replacing it to be something completely new and different, right? Because we know from the research and the history that our child welfare system was based in racism and inequities and things that are not serving our families and kids well. But we also know that it's currently serving kids and families that need services. And so while we replace it, we need to have something that is actually managing that. So you can't just stop it, right? It can't just stop and blow up and be something new tomorrow. And so there really are kind of two tracks. And this is something that Will and his team have done so well over time is how do you implement and transform, right? And how do you do that at the same time? So how do you run a safety net system while you're replacing a system? And that's what we're working on. So that we're getting out of this conversation about whether we're continually improving a broken system or we're abolishing it, but we're actually working on both. How do we replace a system that we know doesn't work while still keeping kids safe at the same time?
Yeah, I think tinkering is what I feel like, you know, kind of having been in the field like both of you for a long time. It feels like what we do, we adjust it this way, we adjust it that way. And while certainly some things are better, it often feels like something we try to improve negatively impacts something else.
Always.
Yeah. Will, what thoughts do you have on that?
Yeah. In the book, it talks about unintended consequences. And so as you were talking about tinkering, and I think about the times that through people's best efforts and best intentions, but still things happening with children and families that were not intended, were not foreseen. One of the things that I think is important about this book, and when you, like in chapter 9, there's some language in there, and the title of chapter 9 is Securing and Restoring the Family is in the Child's Best Interest. Okay? And it questions some of how the current system is engineered. I mean, it's engineered to separate families. It's not engineered to support families. It goes back and questions some of these kind of premises that a number of us have worked under for years. And there's also a chapter in here where a person is talking about when they were beginning as a child protective investigator. It resonates with me because I have some of the same experience. When the guidance you're getting is, we don't want to be in the paper tomorrow, when there's not honest, deep discussion about what are these families struggling with and why are we seeing the scenarios that we're seeing, what questions are we asking? That really resonates with me from being early in my career and young and having to make some of those decisions. And I think another thing in the book that really resonated with me is the idea of the imminent issue of safety right now, as opposed to the impact of separating a child from their family, and the times where even if it's your intent to then go and really search for relatives to see what other resources are there, but then you get caught in the next case that you're going out on, the next investigation. That's eloquently explained in the book, and that resonates with me as well.
Well, it's interesting, Will, after our conversation and kind of getting ready to talk today, I was thinking about how these cases begin and whether in your state it's called a shelter petition or a preliminary protective hearing. What if every time we started that hearing, in addition to presenting the risks to the child, we had to present the impacts and the traumas of removal? No one's going to do that, but why don't we?
I think if we did that, we would not be removing kids, because I think that's what we all know, right? If you take the time to, well, one, if you're ever there when a kid's removed, because I've been there, I think, like, or if you read the research and you look into it at all, you know that it's traumatic. Every removal is traumatic. And only the very, very, very extreme cases of physical or sexual abuse are ones mm-hmm. in which a kid actually needs to be removed and the trauma is worth it because of that immediate safety risk. And every other situation, it's better off for us to figure out how to fix the housing issue, fix the poverty, fix the neglect, fix the education, fix whatever else is going on in the home with that family and keep them together. Because the research and everything I've seen is shows that the trauma is going to outweigh that safety risk. If we can figure out how to mitigate it, which if we actually work with community, I mean, that's really what we're trying to talk about. Like this idea of a replacement system is completely reimagining what the system is, right? It's growing it from a community-based, strengths-based view where the community takes care of itself, right? With the resources of a child welfare system where they actually have services that meet the needs of their community, meaning it meets the needs of whatever racial, ethnic, you know, socioeconomic, religious situation is in that community. And they're there to help be that safety net. And the family can be supported through that if they don't have their own natural supports. If we actually had that in place, right, then we wouldn't need this large child welfare system. And think about all these social workers and even child's attorneys who go into this work to help families, help kids do good in the world. Like, think about them being able to switch their work into actually supporting and strengthening families and communities rather than doing what we're doing now. It's a huge, it's a huge opportunity. It gets me excited.
One other thought here, and Angela, like with the scenario that you were describing on that shelter day and us having a better understand of well-being mm-hmm. for families, well-being for parents, and what does that mean around mental and behavioral health? What does that mean about physical health issues? What does that mean about the economic issues that are impacting the families? And to where if those things are being talked about during that hearing, that instead of the deficit, that's a dynamic shift that requires training, that requires willingness, that requires knowledge, that requires collaboration with mm-hmm. other agencies,
the community.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And a shift in the resourcing, right? A shift in the resourcing so that you're actually involved early on with every family. We're not really othering families, right, for their worst mistakes anymore. We're saying every family at some point probably needs some support. How do we fund that? How do we support that at the community level before things get, you know, immediate or safety risks or come to the attention of law enforcement or the courts or the medical profession?
One of the interesting things that is in the book is some of the work that Public Knowledge is doing in terms of demonstration sites. Can you talk a little bit about these demonstration sites and how that's being implemented?
Yeah, so far we've worked in one state and then one county, and we want to work in more. So we are always looking for opportunities to work at either a state or a county level. What we've learned so far, kind of at a high level, is, you know, we already knew this was going to be hard, right? There's going to be pressures coming from every direction. There's definitely more political pressures and leadership pressures than what we had anticipated at the beginning. But I think we also have learned that there's a ton of work that can be done and good that can be done. And we're seeing in the actual numbers, right, of faster permanency. We're seeing in the county work that we're doing, we're seeing kids that have been in the system for 2+ years finding adoptive homes or going back home to their families. And in that one in particular, they just got a federal grant. And so we're also now doing work on disproportionality because they have a very large disproportionate group of Black children in that community. And so we're starting to address that again at that community level, all with the same core replacement work that we were doing before. And it's really exciting to see it. I think the good part about this work is that it can be done in any political environment because it's not about politics, right? It can be done, I really believe, in any state, city, or county, whether you're rural or urban, and we want to test that. So part of what we're doing with the demonstration sites is partnering with either a child welfare agency or a group of nonprofits. It can be either or both. But the goal is to try it in enough places that we can show with the evidence that it works so that it can be done in other places to a wider degree. But again, we're not stopping the work. We're not leaving a hole or a gap with the safety of kids and the system as is. But we're able to actually demonstrate that the things that we're doing with the community, and it's driven by lived expertise. It's driven by the people in the community that are served by the system, right? And so a lot of control has to be given up by the professionals in order to make this work, which can be scary and fearful and hard, but it's worth it. And I think this is why this book makes me so excited. So the content of the book is available on our website for free. The goal of the book is not to make money. The goal of actually publishing it in a book that looks professional is to elevate the voices of those with lived expertise that contributed to it because they spent their time to do it and share their stories and share their art and share their poetry. And we want to make sure that people are hearing them because I think that's how we move systems. That's how systems change occurs. It's not going to change because of the professionals, because unfortunately we're way too entrenched, right? In the work that we're doing day in and day out. The only way that it's going to change is if we can listen to the people that we're there for. And unfortunately, no one listens to their voices. And it's a very confidential proceeding. So they're not in the paper. They don't have money to hire out lobbyists, right? They're not out there knocking on doors. And so this was our way of giving back in a way to say, listen up, these kids and these families, they matter. And we've got to do better. We have to do better by them.
Well, and I did have the opportunity to read the book, and I value lived expertise, as, you know, does anybody. But I do want to say that there's a difference in being involved in cases and seeing things occur that you know are not fair and are not right, and reading the entire story from the perspective of the parent. And I will say to you, I hate to use the word excruciating because that sounds so negative, but really,
it's excruciating.
It's excruciating. There were several stories where I literally just became so frustrated reading the story, whether it was the way a parent was treated and felt, they were treated by the system, to the stories of domestic violence and the way the women in those stories were treated. So lawyers are probably still one of the fields that like to have the whole book in their hand. I have mine right here and I like to tab it and write in it. So I do want to say to folks that regardless of how long you've been in the field, this is a very powerful book. It has concrete ideas and stories that you can actually use in your office for training to facilitate conversations. So I would highly, highly recommend to folks getting their hands on it so you can work with it, so you can read it again. I'm going to read some of these stories again. Sometimes you just lose track of why you're here and like, what are we doing? And then you read that and you're like, right, and this is why.
And Angela, I think with the stories in the book, there's a lived experience in terms of poverty that comes through. And I think it comes through for me as a reader, it comes through in a very compelling, real way of then thinking about someone knocking at your door and the power of kind of the authority coming in and how you're living your life, how you're experiencing it, and frankly, how vulnerable that is. And then to be in situations where you know you're not being heard.
Yeah.
That comes through in a powerful way with these stories.
I think it's the last sentence says that she still lives in fear of a knock at the door.
You used excruciating. When I was reading these stories back in, I think it was 2022, it was heartbreaking. And I think heartbreaking too, because like you, I've dedicated my career to this work. And I knew and I saw that heartbreak at the beginning of my career. And knowing it's still occurring is just, it's heartbreaking. So I think in a lot of ways, hopefully it's a call to action, right? Like, we can do better. We have to do better. It's been way too long that we've been tinkering with a system that's broken. And it's not fair to kids. I think we can make a difference with one family, right? And we can also make a difference at a systems level. And I don't think it's either or. I think we all have a part in doing whatever we can in both of those places. And I think that's what's exciting about the child attorney's role, the GAO role, is there is an awful lot of influence there with how a family's treated and how a child's taken care of and how a system works.
I think the excruciating part for me, it goes to what you were saying about being in the field for a long time. And I want to speak directly to our listeners who have been at this for many years. You don't want to feel like nothing is better, because certainly some things are.
And very much.
And for anyone who's done any sort of therapy, the idea of being able to hold two ideas at one time, which is there are things that are now better and we still have a system that's fundamentally not working. There's a way to just own both of those and be proud of the cases we worked on and the things that we did and still look at the system and say, you know what? And we still need something bigger and better change than what we've done to date. There was a part that you wrote in the book that I also found incredibly powerful. We use the doctor analogy a lot too, in terms of the role of the children's lawyer. So when I read your section on the correct diagnosis, it really warmed my heart. So I would love it if you could give a preview into that idea for our audience.
Yeah. In May of 2021, I was diagnosed with cancer. And the initial diagnosis was a very rare form of cancer. Prognosis was not good. And thankfully, the first oncologist said, you need a second opinion. We need to get you elsewhere. And when I went to the next institution, the oncologist and the pathologist said, we got some real questions about this diagnosis. We're going to do some further work. And so there was about 4 weeks of kind of limbo there, but I knew that they were gathering more information and looking at what the diagnosis is. I'll never forget the phone call from the oncologist. I was at my brother's house and he said, Will, the pathologist, we're changing your diagnosis, and the diagnosis is a form of lymphoma that I can treat. We have evidence, we have experience. So, you know, it goes from this dire diagnosis to at least something that he's got some confidence around and some experience with. So then it did make me kind of think about my life's work and my work around child welfare, and thinking about the time that decisions have been made without full information, where decisions have been made without the time to be professionally curious about really what is happening in this situation? What else do I need to know? What else do we need to know as the group of professionals working with this family? Do we really understand what's happening with the children and the parents who are experiencing this? And why? Yeah.
Why are we here?
I used to do child and family service reviews for the federal government, for the Children's Bureau. I was part of the team that would go across the country doing those. So we had safety, permanency, and well-being measures that we would look at case by case for the cases that were reviewed. And we would look at child visits. Child visits with their biological parents, child visits with their siblings, child welfare worker visits with the different parties. And the number of times that those are not happening, or the number of times that there's not a way that they can be done in a meaningful way so that people are able to maintain their relationship. There's reference to this in the book, being a young child welfare worker and not being a parent yourself. Now that I'm a parent, the thought of not being able to see my child.
Yeah.
And then the callous way that that's handled.
In an office, in a somebody watching you.
Without thinking about the well-being of that child, the well-being of those parents. I'm getting a little emotional here thinking about it.
Yeah.
Because it's that core. It's that human. It's that basic.
It's that important, I think, is the core. Yeah. Glad that you brought it up, because I used to say the same thing when I was training children's attorneys, is think about sitting in your law school class and looking around that room. And if you're a parent, how many of those attorneys would you want to be making decisions for your kids? How many of them would you trust to make decisions for your kids? Because I'm a mom of three. And let me tell you, not a one of them. Like, and it isn't that I, you know, don't like them or think that they're good attorneys or good humans, but I don't want them making decisions about my kids and my family. Like, no, no way in heck would I trust them, because I'm the expert at that. I know my kids. I know my family. And the kids or the parents in our child welfare systems feel the exact same way, and they should feel the exact same way. And I think that's the challenge, is how do we get in there? How do we understand? How do we figure out what those strengths are? How do we capitalize on those strengths and support them through what's most likely the hardest, scariest time of their lives? And, you know, back when I was doing that, I had kids that I'd talked to in our program who not only didn't know who their attorney was, but had never met them. So it's not just the social workers. And again, no blame or shame, because those attorneys also had caseloads of 100, 200. So the last thing that I want to do here is blame or shame anyone. I think what Will is saying is the right thing to do. We need to be asking questions. What's happening here? Why are we where we're at? Because it's not okay.
And Stacey, that's kind of the bookend to the chapter that I wrote in the book and my experience. You know, when your oncologist says to you, I use you as a case example with my medical students, and the example is the importance of a correct diagnosis, it does just kind of really make you think about, have we gathered the information? What else do we need to know? What other voices do we need to be hearing? What other information do we need?
As you were talking and feeling the emotion of not being able to see your kids, I can't say that out loud without feeling emotional too.
Yeah.
I think it's a good opportunity to think specifically about our primary audience of children's lawyers. One of the things that you have to do is put on some armor to be able to do your work. Because if you let all of it in, you won't make it, right? You have to have some separation, but you can't block all of it out either. Because that's how we end up in these systems where we no longer question the fact that a parent sees their child once a week and not every day. We no longer question those things. And so it's a really so unique in our field in that way. We like to give concrete takeaways for the lawyers that are listening. And I think one of them that fits nicely with this message here is really the children's lawyer's approach to our system of case planning and looking at families. One of the things that we think can be incredibly powerful is for the children's lawyer to look at the case plan and ask for removing things that a parent doesn't need. If a child is a healthy weight and going to school, what are we doing with parenting classes? What is the one thing that they actually need help with? And so I just want to remind folks that that is a power you have today. You can go in and you can look at that case plan. And you can be like, this parent has the primary issue is this, and let's just do that. That's enough. And that's really powerful. From the judge's perspective, you expect it from a parent attorney, even if you don't get it. You expect that a parent attorney is going to be trying to pull as much out as you can. But when you hear it from the child's attorney, I think it does, it catches people off guard unless it's a regular practice and can be very powerful.
Yeah, I love that one. I think that's a huge one. And I think really focusing in on what brought the parents to the attention of the system will help the child's attorney really hone in on what's necessary, right? And I think the other one is to get creative. You know, I had one case where we had to have weekly meetings, and the kid was struggling in school. It was a teenager, and the parent was struggling, missing time from work. And so all the professionals went to the kid's school for the weekly meeting, and the parent called in so we put that in the court order that all the professionals had to do that. And it wasn't that they didn't want to, don't get me wrong, because it cost them more and it was harder for them. But I was able to advocate for that for the family, so the kid didn't miss any more school. We did it over the kid's lunch hour and brought pizza in, so he didn't miss any more school, and the parent was able to call in. And so finding ways to get creative and advocate for the kids and the parents is a huge role for that child's attorney and can really make a big difference for the family.
Well, I think another thing that you've mentioned before is about when interviewing your clients, when talking to the child, asking about the strengths, asking about the good things. Maybe you could talk a little more about that too.
Yeah, I think so often, and this is, I think, part of the hope and resilience, right, of that we all have to carry with us in this work, but also a reminder of hope and resilience in families is there's not one family I've worked with over the time that hasn't had, you know, so many strengths there. Yeah, they all have had challenges, but there's so much there. And learning about what those are and understanding them will open up all of those creative solutions for you. It'll allow you to understand the parents more, understand their natural supports more, understand that child more. And so just simply asking questions and remaining open and curious to what are the strengths? What are the things that you love doing with your family? When are you happiest with your parents? Who do you rely on? Who do you spend time with in holidays? Like, those types of things that you can get to know will allow you to understand what you can do to help mitigate some of those risks, but also how to be creative and how to help support them.
And I think it's that balancing, kind of like we talked about in the beginning, of all we're asking is like trying to find the problem. And that is a lawyer. I mean, let's face it, we're trained to make sure you're getting the whole story, but we got to be asking for the good stuff too.
And part of the whole story is that. And I think that's what's so, and I think that's the focus on the well-being. We spent I feel like the last 2 or 3 decades focused on this fight between safety and permanency. Is it permanency that's more important or safety that's more important? And I feel like we've just lost any type of focus on well-being for kids and families. And it's such an important piece of it is what's the whole picture here?
It's interesting to me, Angela's earlier comment about kind of some of the armor that we can have on. Mm-hmm. So this focus on strengths, or at least openness to strengths. I think the other thing is an openness to people can change and circumstances can change. And I know personally, I'm banking on that for me and my family. I believe that. And I think we've got to guard against our armor and our things that will even kind of undercut that.
Absolutely.
I think there's some language in the book about the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Some of those kind of...
I hate that one.
Right. Mm-hmm. But some of that thought process and having to get beyond that.
Yeah. Because it didn't work in one case, it won't work in this one. And that really does close you off.
Right.
And yeah.
Well, and I live in a very small town. So for those in rural America, what you end up with is a system of law enforcement, social work, and a child welfare system that sees a last name and assumes
that
they're in the right place, right? And there's just an awful lot of judgment and not giving anyone a chance to do anything different because they're like, oh, I've seen your grandparents, your great-grandparents, your parents, and so you have a new baby and you can't do it. You're not going to make it. Well, how is anyone going to succeed under that type of judgment and pressure? Rather than, hey, you had a bad deal growing up. Let me help you get through this and do it different. You can change the trajectory of your life and your kid's life. Let's look at what that might look like together. Like, that's a very different strengths-based way to approach a family and a new parents than, you know, how we do with that apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
So much more powerful. There's so many things about this book that I would love to talk about, but I feel like we've given a preview for folks that they are going to want to get this. We will have the link in the show notes. I want to highlight a couple other things. You can get that book at Amazon, and if you do, please rate it. It does help. We want people to see the book because it is incredibly powerful. And I did want to, I understand, Stacey, that you all have a podcast as well. So we wanted to promote that to our audience too.
Yeah, we also have a podcast. It's called Public Knowledge Igniting Impact. And we go into depth on these topics, a lot of child welfare topics, but also the ancillary systems around child support, health and Medicaid, voc rehab, workforce services. So if you're interested in any more depth on those, we'd love to have you take a listen.
Yes, and we'll link to that as well. So Will and Stacey, thank you both so much for taking the time to talk to our audience today and for bringing this resource to life. It's really incredible.
Thanks so much for having us, Angela. It's been great again.
And thanks everyone so much for listening. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.